Today on Against the Grain, the genocide in Gaza has taken place in front of the eyes of the world with little consequence. Gilbert Achecar argues that the destruction of Gaza is a watershed moment in history, signaling the irretrievable collapse of the Western promise of the rule of law. He also discusses how the rise of the far right in Israel foreshadowed the ascendancy of the hard right in the West. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. 2 years ago, Hamas's surprise attack on Israel killed nearly 1,200 people. In the 24 months that have followed, Israel has relentlessly assaulted the Palestinians of Gaza, destroying their universities and hospitals, their homes and their cities. While an accurate count of the dead and injured is difficult, it's estimated that more than 67,000 Palestinians have been killed, with 20,000 of those children. Lebanese scholar Gilbert Achecar is Professor Emeritus of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, University of London. In Gaza Catastrophe, the Genocide and World Historical Perspective, he steps back to place the genocide in the context of the rule of law and the rise of the far right following World War II. I had a chance to speak with him before the shaky Gaza ceasefire was announced. Here's our conversation. Why do you think that the genocide in Gaza, beyond the obviously massive horror that it entails, also marks a watershed in modern history?
It has been and it is still going on, of course, such a tragic event. And the contrast between Western governments' attitude towards this genocide, this genocidal war, and their attitude towards the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to take these two contemporary and almost simultaneous in time tragedies, the contrast in the attitude has completely discredited any pretense on the part of Western government and, I would say, Western liberal governments, because we have to remember that this reached a peak already under Joe Biden before the second coming, if one could say, of Donald Trump. That contrast has been so sharp, so blatant, that it has really ruined this pretense, any pretense of abiding by some rules-based international order, international law, international institutions. I mean, of course, we have been used to these institutions being discarded or disregarded by various governments, and above all, the U.S. government. The United States has most often, probably more than any other state on earth, been violating those rules and behaving unilaterally in a whole number of wars and aggressions, but. There was the excuse of the Cold War, if you want, after the Second World War. We went into the Cold War, and this was a kind of excuse, provided an excuse to this violation of international rules. But then you had the end of the Cold War in the 90s, and people believed that here we are going to start again on a new and firm basis this time. And that was, you know, if you remember the New World Order I mean, that was in the 90s a very well-known formula, but that was part of a speech by George Bush Sr., promising a new world order based on the rule of law. And of course, I mean, at the end of that decade of the 90s, already you had a first violation of the rules of international law in the Kosovo War, which circumvented the UN Security Council. But then you had, a few years later, a much bigger, I mean, in terms of size and dramatic character, a much bigger violation with the occupation of Iraq in 2003. So, of course, this whole construction of the international order, the international institutions, and all that has been, of course, very much weakened over time. But there was still a semblance of attachment to that, in the fact that there were oppositions within Western governments, for instance, to the invasion of Iraq. The French government, the German government opposed this, and you had people, you had a president in the United States coming after George W. Bush, which was Barack Obama, who was proud of having opposed that war, that the occupation of Iraq. So you still had this hope, let me say, or illusion, one could say also, that something could be done with this with these institutions of international relations. But then I think what happened now with the succession of the Ukraine war and then the Gaza war, and the huge contrast in the attitude of the governments, and I emphasize again, the liberal forces, not only far-right forces like what Donald Trump represents, but before him Joe Biden and those whatever liberal governments there are still in Western Europe, they showed such a double standard that it completely ruined this whole international order that they pretended to respect. And in that sense, I think, as I wrote also, I think the Gaza war, this genocide, this ongoing genocide, has been the occasion for the final nail in the coffin of this so-called rules-based international liberal order that they were promoting. It's dead today, and the world in which we are is more and more obviously one where some kind of law of the jungle prevails. And of course, the United States under Donald Trump has taken that very quickly to a peak.
So to make sense then of what you've just described, you know, you've given us a sense of how events have unfolded in this system, the so-called rules-based international order has unraveled over since World War II. But to make sense of it, I'd like to ask you, going back to that time, to have you describe the order that was put in place after World War II, and of course the genocide of the Holocaust. What were its components and what were the driving forces behind establishing that framework?
Well, I think that basically there was a progressive vision at work there. And that was, to a large extent, due to Franklin Roosevelt being at the helm of the United States, and with him Eleanor Roosevelt. There was this vision which even today looks quite progressive when you compare it to the actual state of international relations. So you had this set of institutions that were built at that time, the United Nations, Its charter, which is based on quite progressive principles, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that came later, the new Geneva Conventions regulating the war and the law of war, if you want, the International Court of Justice to settle problems between states. So you had a set of institutions that were built at that time, which with the view to you know to, draw the lessons from the two huge catastrophes that the world had known, the First and the Second World War, and build a framework of international relations that would allow for, let's say, a civilized world and based on some forms of the rule of law. That you had this vision, and this vision was buried to a large extent quite soon after. With I mean, one key factor being the death of Roosevelt and having Truman to succeed him. Truman, who represented at that time the right wing of the Democrats, and who was played a key role in the shift towards the Cold War. And we got into the Cold War and anti-communism, and in the United States, McCarthyism, and all. I mean, the 50s were terrible years. And of course, this whole construction of an international order got very much stalled during that time, emptied from much of its content. It would be revived every time you had some kind of détente, as it's called, in international relations. Between the two blocs, the Soviet bloc and the US-led Western bloc, in periods of, let's say, more cordial relations and renewal of the talk of disarmament, and especially nuclear disarmament, you would see some kind of resumption in attempting to work through these institutions. So that's why the hope remained, even though the conditions of the Cold War were not very much helping in this regard. And then you had the end of the Cold War, and the renewal of these hopes went along with a further layer of institutions, like the International Criminal Court, which came therefore in the 90s after the end of the Cold War. The difference being between the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, whereas the latter is between states, the new one, the International Criminal Court, could prosecute individuals and point to individual responsibility in what is happening, especially in genocide and horrors of this kind. You had the adoption also by the UN General Assembly of a resolution on the responsibility to protect, which means the responsibility to prevent genocide, precisely, and the responsibility of the international community of the world, if they see an ongoing genocide somewhere, to do everything possible to stop that, to prevent that from happening or from continuing. And all this has collapsed completely now because of what we are seeing, which is at the same time the first televised genocide in history. I mean, anyone wanting to see what's happening can see it. There are a few TV networks, like well known, like Al Jazeera and other Arab actually networks, and then parallel or alternative networks, progressive networks, which are showing, which have been showing what is happening, the horror that is happening, and yet we've seen this absolutely outrageous, scandalous position by the Western governments, which for most of them have been supporting this war, even rejecting calls for a ceasefire for very long, and for, in the case of the United States, still not only supporting but taking part in this war, because I describe this war as the first joint U.S.-Israeli war ever. I mean, of all the wars waged by Israel since the creation of the state, which was itself linked to a war in 1948, of all the wars waged by the Israeli state, this is the first one that can be described accurately as a fully joint U.S.-Israeli war. From the point of view of arming, funding, and supporting politically. You haven't had U.S. Troops on the ground, except for very few for some anti-missile defense systems. But basically, all the rest is there. And this is a war in which Israel would not have been able to do what it is doing and to carry on, and after 2 years still being going on without full U.S. support. And this includes also the political support to the war, as we can see continuing now from Joe Biden to Donald Trump.
And we'll return precisely to that question of the U.S. deep involvement in the Gaza genocide. I should say I'm speaking with scholar of international relations Gilbert Achkar, author of Gaza Catastrophe, The Genocide in World Historical Perspective. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned the liberal international order, which was strengthened after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and the way its framework was expanded. How was that framework used, though, as a way, you know, that framework which institutionalized what would seem like more checks on intervening in cases of genocide? But how was that used as a way for the United States to actually exercise its power and hegemony through a kind of liberal democratic means?
Well, the key point in this regard is that the 1990s, with the end of the Cold War, were the heyday of liberalism, political liberalism. It looked like the Western liberalism had triumphed over the Soviet Union and its bloc of states, and therefore this liberal order prevailed. And of course, many people believed, I would say, naively, that we would get into a recognition of this rule of law at the global level by all states. Well, I never shared that illusion, I must say, because very early on, since the 90s, I pointed to what I saw as the genesis of a new Cold War. And I published 2 years ago a book with this title, The New Cold War, which includes pieces I had written in the 90s, showing how we got into a new Cold War, which is a triangular one between Russia, China, and the United States. And this is determined by U.S. The United States' drive to hegemony, to maintain hegemony. And during the 90s, people were speaking or describing the 90s as the unipolar moment. And the United States was very much in the business of trying to consolidate this unipolar hegemony globally. And that is what produced the new Cold War, because China, as a rising power, which started really rising during that same period, and Russia, when it started recovering from the collapse of the Soviet Union, both of them were faced with the United States trying to impose its hegemony over them and over the world. And that's why they used this term, hegemonism, quite profusely in their joint statement and the rest. And so, whatever frame was put in place, it was always meant by the United States in particular to be used according to U.S. needs. That is, whenever, for instance, the United Nations and international law are compatible with U.S. Some U.S. goal, then they make use of them. But when they aren't, they just ignore them. They just disregard them completely, as we have seen. As I said, you had the Kosovo War, you had the Iraq War, the Iraq occupation, and now, most blatantly, if you want, you have this this Gaza War, which is such a dramatic violation of every single component of international law is violated here. Every component, every article of the law of war is violated. It is truly a genocide by even the legal definition of that, as is increasingly acknowledged by every kind of institution, from UN institutions to legal institutions or judicial, like the international courts, to human rights organizations, including Israeli human rights organizations. So, I mean, the evidence and the consensus on this is becoming really, truly overwhelming. And yet, you find the United States at the helm in this most blatant and dramatic violation of all rules.
Well, let me ask you more about that. Trump clearly is not committed to that Atlanticist liberalism that was consolidated in the 1990s and in the 2000s. But Biden, who actually was the president who presided over the start of this genocide, was ostensibly committed to the centrality of the U.S. within this Atlantic-based liberal international order, certainly a lip service to a rules-based system of global governance. How do you understand Biden's motives in participating in this joint effort, which is the genocide in Gaza?
Biden is someone who, by his age, lived the Cold War, lived the practices of that time, and the time that came after, but from a rather quite right-wing perspective when it comes to international relations, whatever his views on domestic issues, his views on international issues were far from being progressive. And we saw that. I mean, he already was kind of a right-wing correction, if one could say, to Barack Obama when Barack Obama was president. He was his vice president, but he was pushing things to the right in international affairs, and most obviously on the issue of Israel. He was the kind of pro-Israel person in the Obama administration. He deflected some attempts at of this administration of Barack Obama himself. Some very limited attempts, one should say, but there were some inclination to take action against, for instance, the settlements, the development of settlements by Israel in the 1967 occupied territories. And Biden is known to have acted to try to block that, to prevent that. So when he became president, he went along with the same logic. First, in international relations, it was flawed from the start, like, you know, convening summits for democracy, so-called summits for democracy, with obvious anti-democrats like the Indian Modi, the Hungarian president, at some point Bolsonaro, the Brazilian, was even invited. So those so-called summits for democracy were the same game of yesteryear, if you want, of the Cold War period. That is, we call democracy very authoritarian governments, provided they are anti-communist. So in that case, it is calling democracy democracy very right-wing governments, but provided they may stand with the United States against China or Russia. That was the same Cold War game. And then you had this Gaza war. And here there is a specific dimension to Joe Biden. I mean, beyond, because, you know, we are used to analyze the action of states in the light of their material interest or strategic interest. And of course, this applies, first of all, to the mightiest state on earth, which is the United States of America, right? But there is also a personal dimension. In any state, the staff that is leading the state, they have their own idiosyncrasies, one could say, and that is very specific to the personalities that are involved. And in this case, this ardent pro-Zionism of Joe Biden definitely played a key role in his attitude, in his full support to the genocidal war that Israel launched after October 7, 2023. He, I mean, I counted the number of times that he proclaimed from the White House while being president. You know, while being president, and he's the first president ever in U.S. history to proclaim that he is a Zionist while being president, not at some point or publicly proclaim that, not in some private meeting. But he did that not once, but half a dozen times while he was president. Repeating and repeating that he is a Zionist and that one doesn't need to be Jewish to be a Zionist, which is absolutely true, by the way, because most Zionists in the United States are Christians, are not Jews, are not Jewish. Christian Zionism is by far the most important support and ally of the Netanyahu government, of the far-right government in Israel today. So Biden has a direct personal responsibility in also in this collapse of this remnant of the world order. And since Western liberalism, Atlanticist liberalism, having triumphed after the Cold War, after the 90s, led to this catastrophe and to the discredit of its own pretensions, so everything collapsed with it. And we are in a world that is back to the jungle more and more. And that's actually frightening when you see that this happening at the same time that you have a global rise in neo-fascism, in the far right, in the 21st century modernized equivalent of what the previous century has witnessed between the two world wars of the rise of fascism and Nazism and the rest. Well, they are not being reproduced in the same forms as a century ago, but we have the modern equivalent of that, with some differences. They are not paramilitary organizations as you had with the Nazis or the Italian fascists. And they claim to be democratic, like Trump would claim to be the embodiment of democracy, which wasn't a pretense that the fascists or the Nazis had. But beyond that, the ideology, the ultranationalism, the xenophobia, the racism, sexism, all these are the same extreme levels that you had. And this makes the whole issue much more dangerous today on a background of very worrying climate change, with these same far-right forces starting with the Trump administration being opposed to any action against climate change. And that adds a layer, if you want, of tragedy to the whole thing.
What do you make of the complicity of European states in the genocide perpetrated against Gaza? States that don't have the same close relationship to Israel as the United States has?
The European states, most of them, had the same attitude as the United States in supporting the war. Of course, their material contribution to the war was much more limited, although some of them, like Germany, comes second after the United States in terms of military relations and aid to Israel. Britain, France, all of them had some forms of relations. And they all reacted to October 7 in support of the Israeli onslaught, even though this onslaught was clearly based on a genocidal intention from the very beginning, when the Israeli Minister of Defense, immediately after the attack of October 7, proclaimed that he was cutting food, water, electricity, any kind of supply to the whole Gaza Strip, and called the enemy human animals. I mean, which is the kind of vocabulary that goes along with the genocidal intentions, very classically. So even though you had a blatant violation of the law of war, imposing these kind of conditions on a whole civilian population, the Western governments, the European governments, not only the United States, but the European governments supported this war, and most of them carried on supporting it for quite long, to the point of joining the United States in rejecting calls to a ceasefire. And you know, when you reject calls for a ceasefire, that is obviously, that means that you are supporting the continuation of the war, even though it was very clearly just, I mean, in a few days, Israel had killed much more of the population of Gaza than whatever a number of Israeli were killed on October 7. I mean, you had 1,200 people killed on October 7. Well, in a matter of few days, you had close to 10 times this falling in Gaza in a matter of very few weeks. So these European governments took that kind of attitude out of identification with Israel, looking at Israel as a kind of part of the West in the Middle East, a Western state, a kind of Western outpost in the Middle East, also invoking their historical responsibility in the Nazi genocide of the Jews, as if that would be a reason for supporting whatever a state that claims to be a state of the Jews or a Jewish state, as it calls itself, it wants to call itself, whatever they do. This said, I think that with time, one after the other, these governments started seeing that it was going too far, farther than they could carry on supporting. So they started changing their position. Like the French government, after a few months of the war, changed its position on the issue of the ceasefire and others. So you had progressively some change. They started feeling guilty for what is going on. And in order to exonerate themselves or to whitewash their own position, we see them now moving towards the recognition of a state of Palestine, which first of all, is coming very, very late because the State of Palestine was proclaimed by the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1988. And secondly, it comes at, I mean, today, the State of Palestine issue is coming at a time when whatever foundations for such a state have been completely destroyed, smashed, crushed, and nothing of that kind could emerge other than some entity which would be completely and fully under Israeli control, as has been actually the case of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. That's where the European states are today in this uneasy position, you see them, because after having supported this war, they want to take some distance today, and also with the Netanyahu government. And I would have said funnily, but it's not funny, we are not speaking of anything funny, but what is happening is that the Netanyahu government is turning against these governments what they had been using against the Palestine solidarity movement in their countries, which is the accusation of anti-Semitism. And now they are the ones accused of anti-Semitism by the Netanyahu government. So that's the situation in which we are.
Well, how do you see the conflation, what you just mentioned, the conflation of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, which these European countries used, as you say, against critics of their support of Israel? You had mentioned earlier the rise of the right globally, which obviously includes Europe. How do you see the relationship between that growth of the far right and the conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism? Obviously, the far right was growing before then, but do you think that that played a role in giving a certain legitimacy to the far right?
The fact is that the drift to the far right that we are witnessing at the global level, and more specifically in Western countries, this has been preceded by the drift to the far right of the Israeli society and polity. The far right, the Likud party, which is the far right of the Zionist movement, came to power in 1977. And has been most of the time in power since then. And then Netanyahu came back to power as a prime minister in 2009 and has been prime minister since then, except for a few months in 2021-22. And then he came back at the end of 22 with by far not only the most right-wing, the most far-right government in Israeli history, because he is in coalition with groups that were called by an Israeli scholar in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz neo-Nazis, and they really deserve this label. He formed a government, a coalition with those most extreme groups. One of them is the heir to a group led by Rabbi Kahan, which at some point was banned in Israel itself as terroristic and banned in the United States as a terrorist organization. And this same current is now part of the Israeli government of Netanyahu. So this drift to the far right preceded and accompanied the global one. And Netanyahu has been one of the key figures in the international far-right phenomenon. He is one of those figures like the Hungarian Orban, like Donald Trump, like several others, and some of them still in the opposition, like the National Rally in France or Reform Party in the UK and the rest. So you have this global far-right, but Netanyahu was a kind of model for many of them in the way also he managed to remain in power within, I mean, exploiting or playing with the democratic game. And that's the difference between neo-fascism and old fascism. Old fascism would just install openly a dictatorship and praise the dictatorial model as the best. Neo-fascism has to adapt to modern times and pretend to be democratic, but there are several tricks through which they empty democracy of its meaning, and you are very well placed in the United States to witness that, because you're witnessing that with what the present far-right government that you have in the United States is doing. And so you have this whole aspect, but then you have to add to this the fact that this Israeli far right has been instrumental in whitewashing the European far right. The European far right, which is a continuation politically of 20th century fascism and Nazism, the European far right had anti-Semitism as a key component of its ideological vision. Anti-Semitism was crucial for them. And of course, after the Second World War, anti-Semitism was very much discredited, and this affected these groups that have their origin in those anti-Semitic far-right forces of the 20th century. Except that the far-right government in Israel played a key role in absolving, if you want, their anti-Semitic sins or past, whitewashing them. We have seen those far-right forces shift into the most ardent defenders of Israel and the Netanyahu government. And today, for instance, I mentioned that European governments are working towards this issue of the state of Palestine, recognition of it. Well, the far right in each of their countries is vocal against this position. 3 months ago, you had a conference, so-called conference to combat anti-Semitism, which was convened in Israel, in Jerusalem, by the Israeli state, to which the key figures of the far right, the European far right, even extreme figures of the European far right were invited. In that sense, the Israeli government is contributing to the build-up, the political build-up that is strengthening these far-right currents, threatening, from a progressive point of view, very much threatening to lead into these currents coming to power. And if you look at the polls, it is very worrying. In Britain, where I am, some days ago, you had the largest far-right demonstration in the history of the country. And the polls show that the far-right party led by Nigel Farage is ahead of both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, the two traditional parties of British politics. It's like having some independent far-right current in the United States heading both the Democrats and the Republicans in the polls, except that, of course, you don't need a far independent far-right party in the United States because the Republicans themselves have turned into that far-right party under the Trump leadership.
Indeed. In the time that we have left, I wonder if we could turn to looking at Gaza for a moment and to Hamas. Speaking of the right, a different version of it, I wonder if you could talk about the circumstances in Gaza before October 7th in terms of the inhabitants of Gaza's relationship to Hamas, as well as the role that Netanyahu played in supporting Hamas before October 7th, 2023.
Hamas seized power in Gaza in reaction to a coup attempt that actually was backed by the United States and staged by the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas, which is now in the West Bank. So you had a split due to that between the West Bank, where the Palestinian Authority remained in power, and Gaza, where Hamas took over. And that came, of course, after elections in which Hamas won a plurality of votes and a majority of seats in what is the equivalent of a parliament for the Palestinians. And since then, you've had no further election. So Hamas has been ruling Gaza since 2007 without any form of election, any kind of election. And that already tells you something about the character of that. And then it had imposed its views, including its interpretation of religion and the rest, on the population. This on a background of very difficult conditions created by the Israeli blockade of the Strip. Now, you've had long studies, articles, and the rest about the way Netanyahu favored the continuation of the Hamas rule in Gaza, including by allowing the transfer of money, in cash actually, from Qatar to the Gaza Strip. And Netanyahu himself is reported to have stated in a convention of his party, the Likud, having boasted about this, about the fact that by doing this, by allowing the Hamas rule in Gaza to consolidate, he was just canceling any possibility of a Palestinian state or and any pressure on him, upon him, by Western governments towards that goal of the Palestine state, which the United States, until now, I should say, or used to regard as official policy, that is, the so-called two-state solution. So he was happy with that. That's how you had this kind of coexistence, albeit with periods of bombing where you would have rockets launched by from Gaza and then a very violent, heavy retaliation from the Israeli side. You've had several rounds of this until you had October 7. It explains also the degree of anger and that build-up among the population in Gaza, and of course contributes to explaining without excusing what happened on October 7. This actually was basically an opportunity that was seized by the Israeli government in order to reoccupy Gaza. Because I should say, and that's important in this regard, that the present Israeli government is composed of people who all of them rejected and opposed vehemently the withdrawal of the Israeli army and the settlers from Gaza in 2005. When in 2005, the Israeli government, which was headed at that time by Ariel Sharon, decided this withdrawal from Gaza, this unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, Netanyahu was a member of his cabinet and he resigned in protest. And those other members of his government are people who were in the streets at that time demonstrating against this withdrawal. So all of them wanted to reoccupy Gaza. And they, of course, they needed an opportunity for that. And that opportunity was provided by October 7.
It is clearly so difficult to try to predict what is going to happen in these incredibly uncertain and tumultuous times, which, as you've said, in many ways break from the ways things have been done, although there are also continuities one can see as well. But in terms of people around the world who are outraged and horrified about the genocide in Gaza and want to express their solidarity and also actually try and make some kind of difference, do you see any places within the world system where pressure could be brought to bear more effectively than others?
Sure. I mean, if we were to look for a silver lining in all this dramatic sequence of events, and the only one is the fact that this genocidal war is so ugly and has that even those who were blind to it at the beginning, were not seeing it at the beginning, has been acknowledging what is happening and revulsed by what is happening. And so you have had a rise in solidarity with the Palestinian people, in empathy with them, and the Palestine solidarity movement that we have been seen developing in universities, but also in the streets, especially if you take in Europe or in Britain, for instance, you had a very large solidarity movement with a huge solidarity demonstrations. So all this is positive, but I would say that the most important ray of hope that I see today in this very, very bleak scenery that we are facing, the most important ray of hope is related to the fact that for the Palestinian people to get their rights, they need to split the Israeli society to create a relation of force that would bring part of this Israeli society to their side in the defense of their rights, as you had, for instance, with the white people in the United States, a large fraction of them supporting the civil rights movement and fighting along the black population for their rights. So for this to happen today, if you look at Israel with this drift to the far right of the Israeli society, there is no way you could be optimistic. But then if you look at what is happening in the United States, which is the most important country for Israel, the country through which Israel is most affected, it is amazing to see the change in the position of the American Jews, and especially young people of Jewish descent in the United States, in turning against Israel and in expressing sympathy and solidarity with the Palestinians. I think this will be the most important factor for the future. Of course, for this to really play a key role, you would need change in government in the United States. You'd need to turn the page of this neo-fascist drive that you have and see a rise of progressive forces. In that case, of course, Israel would be very much affected and everything becomes possible within the Israeli society if the United States society and polity change radically.
Jaber Ashkar, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Gaza Catastrophe, The Genocide in World Historical Perspective. Jaber Ashkar is Professor Emeritus of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, University of London. His many books include The Arabs and the Holocaust, The Arab-Israeli War of Narratives, The Clash of Barbarisms, and with Noam Chomsky, Perilous Power. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.